Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. What's on TV tonight? Cartoons? Better keep the kids away. A recent conservative survey says children's environmental cartoons are giving the wrong message. One producer says no. Yellowstone National Park is big, but it's way too small. Ecologists say we need to think big, really big. Vision mapping. And in nature, everything is used in one way or another.
Only we human beings were capable of making dioxins, heavy metals, nuclear residues. No one wants it. No one wants it in their backyard. No one wants it in their front yard. No one wants it.
Zero Emissions Manufacturing to the Rescue. The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. And this is Bruce Robertson. Sex, drugs, violence, and now environmental issues. These are the reasons we need to keep informed about the television programming our children are watching. This according to John Sheehan, executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Media and Public Affairs. Sheehan says children simply are getting the wrong message about environmental issues.
We found that doom and gloom pervade the environmental world of cartoons, and viewers are warned of the looming crisis, which requires swift intervention to save the planet from destruction. And we found that cartoons tell the kids about problems. The Captain Planet is an unashamed propagandist for environmental activism, and this series aims to educate, motivate, and mobilize children with an approach that at times resembles direct mail. Evil forces are threatening our way of life, and doom is imminent. 9 out of 10 environmental plot lines invoke images of pessimism and destruction, yet despite all the doom and gloom, cartoons endorse the importance of individual change and collective action for solving the problems.
What is more, says Sheehan, the positive messages are also giving the wrong impression. All problems are presented as having a solution, if only we work hard at finding it. And all scientists and business leaders, regardless of their work, are portrayed as the so-called bad guys. Serious charges. Nick Boxer is executive producer of the series Captain Planet and the Planeteers, now known as The New Adventures of Captain Planet.
My response is that our shows are researched. We consult with experts on a regular basis. We try and stay in touch with the most recent research and literature. And we try and do a balanced interpretation of the issue in a story format that kids will understand and can learn from.
As you begin crafting a storyline or a season's worth of stories, what is it? How would you characterize your goal if you are heading toward a message or a theme that you're trying to develop? How do you approach that?
Well, the real focus of the series is, number one, to empower children, to let them know they are going to inherit this planet and that they can shape, you know, sort of its destiny. So it's most important for us that we empower kids. And then number two, we want to inform them about environmental trends, themes, just so they grow up with what I consider a more balanced view of their relationship to the environment.
Sheehan says scientists and business leaders are always portrayed as the worst characters. Boxer says absolutely untrue.
I mean, I can tell you we did a show called Bottom Line Green, in which a villain is trying to sabotage a company and a businessman who is installing environmentally friendly technology to update his factory to recycle chemicals and things like that. We did a show on mass transportation, in which a business plan is putting together a mass transportation program in a Latin American country that is environmentally correct and, you know, is a positive character. We actually have dozens of positive positive role models for scientists and business people. I think what they may be looking at is the villains, who are in fact really not intended in most cases to represent businessmen or scientists, but really to represent the problems themselves. I mean, we have a character, for example, named Hoggish Greedley. And Hoggish Greedley is not like a real person. You know, he's sort of a supervillain. He represents the problem. He represents overconsumption. He represents waste of resources. So he's more allegorical than literal.
Other characters likewise are named Loot and Plunder and Sly Sludge. Sheen says the point is, no matter what the characters are called, it's the message the children are getting that is the problem.
Cartoons rarely educate the kids to the difficult choices that underlie most environmental controversies. For example, programs fail to explore real-life trade-offs between human needs and environmental conservation. The end result may be that they see problems, they think that problems like pollution and solid waste and air can be solved without some sacrifice, because there are simplistic solutions that are offered and not a realistic. There are trade-offs. There are things that we have to give up, and there are sacrifices that have to be made to solve these problems. Just simply recycling our cans is not going to completely solve the solid waste problem.
Again, Nick Boxer.
We are sometimes accused of being one-sided, and one of the things I refute that with is I think society is one-sided. We do not present to children the impact we have on the environment. That is not something you grow up and are taught about. For example, no one says to a child, see this door, see this desk, see this newspaper, see the framing of your house, see the wood floors in your house. All these things mean the trees were cut down. See this baseball bat, see these wood blocks, see these, you know, pencils. All these things mean the trees were cut down. Which is not to say there's anything wrong with cutting down trees. I'm simply saying that we should have, as a society, an understanding of how we're using our resources.
Nick Boxer is executive producer of the syndicated cartoon series The New Adventures of Captain Planet, now in its sixth season, produced by Turner Broadcasting. We spoke to him in Los Angeles. John Sheehan is executive director of the Center for Media and Public Affairs. His television viewing was conducted earlier this spring. Sheehan cautions children and parents not to think of cartoons as news, to which Boxer counters by saying unabashedly, we are an environmental program. This is Bruce Robertson. The bigger the better. In the days of John Muir, Teddy Roosevelt, and the great conservationists of the 19th century, it was a radical idea to mark off huge tracts of land on a map as designated wilderness areas. Yellowstone, the Grand Tetons, the Grand Canyon. Modern conservationists say, while this system worked for its time, we need a new radical idea. Bill McKibben, author of the landmark book The End of Nature and other works, says we need to think big, really big. Doug Freilich tried it and filed this report.
Author Bill McKibben says the old methods of land conservation are not working. We are running out of steam.
On the one hand, they're becoming politically more difficult all the time as try to deal with more settled areas. The old approaches of parks and things get more difficult. And on the other hand, we begin to understand that even those park systems and things weren't big enough and complete enough in many ways.
As we move into the 21st century, a new style of wilderness protection is emerging, reflecting the wisdom of conservation biology. The central idea being, bigger is better. Conservation biologists use vision mapping to create huge tracts of protected wilderness. 26 million acres of northern forest in New England, 20 million acres in the northern Rockies. McKibben says this new thinking is transforming the conservation movement.
Well, it's driven mostly by science, I think. The emerging conservation biology, which is kind of the science that drives it, is a fairly new science and an emerging one, and we're only beginning to understand just how important large size of reserves, for instance, is to protect wild species. And given those large sizes that are required, it becomes necessary to ask how we're going to have human beings and animals interact in the same places. And that's why so much of what's going on is more creative than the old Yellowstone model, you know, identify a pretty place and put a fence around it.
Jamie Sion was one of the first to propose a vision mapping plan. Now editor of the Northern Forest Forum, a bi-monthly journal of the Northern Appalachians, Sion says the idea of vision mapping came to him in, well, in a vision.
1987, I was hiking along the Appalachian Trail in the White Mountain National Forest, and I was asking myself the question, why is it that all the wilderness has to be out west in the Rockies and places like that? Why can't we have some big wilderness in the east? And I got to thinking about the Appalachian Trail connecting Mount Katahdin in the northern reaches of Maine with Springer Mountain in northern Georgia. This is one continuous trail over 2,000 miles long, and I thought, well, if we widened the trail, that corridor of the Appalachian Trail to 3 or 4 or 5 miles wide, and then connected wilderness reserves up and down that chain into the corridor, the Appalachian Trail corridor, in other words, take a reserve that may be 20 miles away from the Appalachian Trail and build a connecting corridor to it, we could effectively create a continuous wilderness reserve system that went from Maine down to Georgia and hopefully even into Florida, and that in theory a wolf or a cougar could hike, you know, from Maine to Florida. Now in practice that probably wouldn't happen, but that there could be this kind of genetic exchange big wild areas.
At first, science proposals were not widely received. Recently, it seems, conservationists are realizing the critical value of Sion's new wildland ethic. Sensing this change, he recently unveiled a proposal to establish an 8-million-acre network of wilderness reserves in northern Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. He says the network would not likely be complete for 75 years, clearly a long-range plan that would make wise use of vision mapping. Even though conservation biologists may be coming around to this method, the question is, will a conservative political and economic climate support this type of proposal? History is rarely predictable, says Sion, citing the abolition of slavery as one example of a changing society.
In the 1780s, people were considered kooks for that. In the 1840s, they were considered kooks. As late as 1857, the Supreme Court reaffirmed the absolute right of the slave owner. And yet slavery was gone by the middle of the 1860s. It happened very fast. On the other hand, a very abrupt, it was a long process with a very kind of abrupt finale. Another process that is much more recent is the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall and communism in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. Were there any political experts in the CIA or in the U.S. government or anywhere else who would have predicted a year before the Berlin Wall came down that this was going to happen? And yet it happened. So just because we've got a colossally ignorant, colossally hostile to the environment Congress today doesn't mean that we will tomorrow or, you know, 10 years from now.
Sion says it was relatively easy to set aside the Yellowstone parks and the Grand Canyons of the nation as wilderness. They are scenic treasures and at the time were of little commercial value. Sion says now we need a new conservation ethic, a strategy that is orders of magnitude greater than anything we employ now. As valuable as Yellowstone is, says Sion, so too is our own backyard. For most of us, he says, this may be difficult to conceive, requiring too rapid a change of attitude. But, says Sion, father of 4.5-year-old Brooke, the hope is with the next generation.
When we're born, and as I say, I have a 4.5-month-old son, so I'm going through this right now. It's a very exciting and wonderful time in my life. When we're born, as Brooke is showing me, we have that connection with the natural world born in us. The delight in his face when I first showed him a very small waterfall and a very small stream about a mile from our house, it's inexpressible, the joy that burst over his face. It was something new and different, but it was natural and wonderful, and it was so exciting to him. And I think that the tragedy that I suffered and that most people suffer as they grow older is that society basically severs that inborn connection with the natural world. So one of the things I'm going to work hardest with in raising Brooke is to see that connection that is there, that was born with him, doesn't get severed. I'm not going to try to make him connect. I'm just going to try to protect him from forces that would sever that connection. If he and his generation can grow up with that connection intact, much of the stuff that's taken for granted by our nature-estranged culture will strike him as nonsense, much the way the culture of slavery seems so natural to people growing up in the 1820s or 1830s, and it seems utterly absurd and alien and deeply offensive to people growing up today.
This is Doug Freilich.
Yet to come, the coming of the new industrial age. For a cassette copy of today's broadcast, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 297. That's 1-800-747-7444. The Environment Show, program number 297. He who finishes with no toys wins, the object being to end up with nothing. This is the idea behind zero-emissions manufacturing, a technique slowly gaining popularity. Industrialist Günter Pauli was the first to experiment with zero emissions when he established the world's first ecological factory manufacturing soap detergent in Europe. Today, Pauli is a special advisor to the Tokyo-based United Nations University. Pauli says we are entering the next industrial revolution, one characterized by this concept of zero emissions.
It's a blend between the impatience of the entrepreneur and the depth of the scientist. It is the desire to find breakthrough solutions to industrial problems, and it really is about imagining that new type of industry where waste does not exist. Because we are supposed to be the intelligent species on Earth, but we're the only ones on Earth that make products no one wants. I mean, in nature, everything which is waste for one is food for someone else. Only we human beings were capable of making dioxins, heavy metals, nuclear residues. You know, no one wants it. No one wants it in their backyard. No one wants it in their front yard. No one wants it. So we have to really see how can we mimic industry. How can we mimic nature and as such have a new paradigm for how industry can function?
The supporting theory behind zero emissions is in turn based on fundamental business practices. Reduce your waste and loss and you increase your profits. Today, Pauli is heading up an academic research team from the United Nations University interested in establishing a zero emissions research institute somewhere in the United States. The Zero Emissions Research Institute, or ZERI, as it would be called, would start from the university home base in Tokyo.
Well, it would function like a virtual university, a virtual research network. I mean, we have these incredible opportunities offered to us on the information highway. In Tokyo at this moment already, on one particular program for converting all waste from the beer brewery into inputs for other industries, we have 210 researchers full-time assisting us in the development of that over the Internet. We only have 6 people full-time. So what we're looking at is creating a permanent information highway hub, a center where electronically we can get all the information together, and once we have designed those total solutions, how we can spread it out again to the world and particularly to industry so they can integrate it practically. So what we're looking at for the United States, or for the world actually, is to have a base in the United States. And why the United States? Well, in the first place, because the United States, from an industrial point of view, is still the leader. And if U.S. industry is embracing this and backing this up, we're very convinced that actually industry all around the world will follow very soon.
Pauli and his team have not only decided the facility should be located in the United States, they further believe one site in particular would be more suitable, Chattanooga, Tennessee. Pauli says the city and the region are particularly well-suited for the ZERI.
What to me is very critical is that, first of all, Chattanooga is this hub around very critical research centers. I mean, the best research centers you will find not just in America, but you will find in the world. You have Oak Ridge, you have Georgia Tech, You have Muscle Shoals, you have Tallahassee, you have Vanderbilt University, you have the University of Tennessee. You have a real stronghold of research capabilities which are topped by Oak Ridge National Laboratories. And therefore, we believe we have an enormous access to research capabilities. And second, you have this unique opportunity that these research that can be developed on zero emissions finds a business community around Chattanooga, which is really ready to be a living laboratory on what zero emissions means in terms of competitiveness, new industries, new type of manufacturing jobs, etc. And I think this mixture of the research capabilities on one hand, and second, this opportunity to put these ideas into practice in this living laboratory, I think that is really what is attracting us in a very unique way.
Pauli cites one example of zero emissions. Fermentation, he says, is a basic process in the food industry. Beer, vinegar, and soy sauce are typical examples of fermentation. While producing the product you want, fermentation also generates a lot of waste that is otherwise unusable. Pauli says this waste is a waste.
What we have done is we looked at all the outputs, point per point, that, for example, a beer brewery or a soya manufacturing or a vinegar manufacturing unit is generating. And we ask us the question, who can do something with that waste? For example, spent grain, which is the residue of the barley after we have brewed the beer. Spent grain is 70% fiber and about 16 to 20% protein. Now today that is given either to the cattle or it's incinerated, and in some cases even it's just landfilled. And we say this cannot be done. What can we do then? Well, we look very practically, what is the most efficient way of using this? We found out through our Chinese scientists that, for example, you can grow mushrooms on this. If you grow the mushroom, the fiber is then converted into a carbohydrate, which is very easy to digest by cattle and makes it very good food. And the protein can be extracted by an earthworm. Now, the earthworm does this on its own. You don't have to add any energy. And then the earthworm becomes an excellent concentrate of protein, which can be given to chicken. Now, this is just to give you the first part of the cycle. We do that in every single step.
Just considering this brewery process, Pauli says the end result is a product that is 7 times more nutritious for humans than the original product alone, beer. In addition, 4 times as many jobs are generated in the process. And this is just from one product. Closer scrutiny of all of our processes will show that zero emissions can be applied with similar results. Pauli says response to zero emissions manufacturing from industry so far has been tremendous. In Japan, 80% of the operating research funds at the university comes from the private sector, that is, industry kicking in the money. In the United States, Pauli says the idea is catching on, with DuPont one of the first to commit to zero emissions. At DuPont headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, employees wear buttons that say, "Ask me about zero." Pauli says with proper direction and channeling, the race to the bottom, to zero, to achieve nothing, could well become the most competitive of business scrambles. Who can achieve the most with the least? ZERI, the Zero Emission Research Institute, to be located in Chattanooga, will be the force channeling and enabling this race to start. Gunter Pauli, a noted industrial theorist and now with the United Nations University, is counting on this happening. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show for this week, and we're certainly glad you joined us. Make a note, tune in again next week for more news on the environment. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE.